You're listening to Passions and Prologues, a literary podcast where each week I interview an author about a thing they love and how it inspires their work. I'm your host, Adam Sokol, and today's author guest is the fabulous Rebecca Mackay. Rebecca is the author of the novels The Great Believers, The 100-Year House, and The Borrower, and her newest book that is taking the literary world by storm is I Have Some Questions for You. If you are unfamiliar, Rebecca's work has made her a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. And also, she has received the ALA's Carnegie Medal and the LA Times Book Prize, among many, many other honors. We get into her work a little bit later in the episode, but before we do that, we talk about her current passion, which is learning the extremely and ridiculously difficult language of Hungarian. We get into why she's learning Hungarian, what makes this language so persnickety and challenging, and it's really, really fascinating. As someone who is currently learning a language myself, I really enjoyed having this conversation with someone who is much further along on the path than I am. I'm also not learning Hungarian, I'm learning French, but we get into that as well. I think you're really, really going to love this conversation. It's extremely fascinating. And Rebecca is one of those authors who every single one of her books, when they come out, there's something that is just so well thought out about her stories. Obviously, every novel that comes out, a lot of thought goes into, but there's just a really interesting way that you can tell she crafts every single sentence. It's as if every single word is in the place it is supposed to be. I think you're going to love this conversation. And before we get to that, I want to give you a book recommendation. I am currently reading The Family Morfowitz by Daniel H. Turtell. I have been describing it as like a Jewish Succession, realizing that lately I have been talking a lot about books that are similar to Succession. That was not by design. The books that I have been picking just sound really good. And then as I listen to them, I'm like, wow, this reminds me of the family intrigue that is littered throughout the show Succession. So The Family Morfowitz tells a story. It is, our narrator's name is Ezekiel, and he is basically the family chronicler. He is sitting with a man named Zev, who is kind of the elder patriarch of the family, who is about to pass away, it seems, and he's telling his life story for the first and only time. And his story starts in a way that basically his whole family escaped the Nazis in Germany, just like their parents had escaped the Cossacks in Russia. Long story short, the whole family ends up in New York. They begin to build a massive empire in New York City, kind of dotting the skyline with places that they own. And what ends up happening is you get this story of all of these intriguing kind of infighting situations that happen amongst siblings and cousins and all these different family members. It is so delightfully Jewish as a person who has Hebrew in my own blood. It was really, really, I'm really enjoying this story. But it is a kind of combination of like the Metamorphoses, if you're familiar with Ovid's tale there, but it's also just a really incredible multi-generational Jewish family saga, which just very much up my alley. So that's The Family Morfowitz, if you are interested. If you'd like any other book recommendations, you can always email me at passionsandprologues@gmail.com. I love hearing from everybody. And if you let me know what your particular passions are, anyone who does that, I give away a random bookshop.org gift card every single month to somebody who does that, just as a thank you, mainly because I love hearing about your passions. Okay, that is all the housekeeping. I'm not going to keep you any longer. I am so excited to say that today's episode is with Rebecca Mackay on Passions and Prologues.
Hey nerds, I'm Sarah, the paper nerd, and if you've ever wondered what goes into that greeting card you just sent or received, well, quite a lot. Get your paper fix on the Paperfold, where I host an enchanting mix of personalities and players all nerding out on my favorite. favorite topic, stationery. From the designs of our snail mail communications to the precious space created when two people correspond, there's a lot to cover. So come grab a seat in the stationery community's only five-star paper salon, The Paperfold, now part of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Okay, Rebecca, what is something you are super passionate about that we're going to be discussing today?
Yeah, at the moment, that would be learning Hungarian, which I am learning. Let's put it that way.
So I love this so much. I'm also learning another language, which I will get into later. But first things first, I did a little research, so I think I know why. But what is the reason you wanted to learn Hungarian?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, great deal of my family, including my dad, are Hungarian. My dad... I was raised in Chicago, but then my father and all these other relatives who were living with us sometimes or living nearby, they were all speaking Hungarian. And my dad never taught it really to me or my sister because he figured he didn't think he could ever go back, let alone that we could go back or would want to. It's like not like a useful language in the world, particularly, right? And so I grew up knowing... a lot of words and some baby talk and hearing it a great deal. But unless you speak it to a kid, they don't learn it. That's why the Einstein videos never worked. Like, that's why those kids aren't all walking around speaking French, right? So at different times in my life, I have made an effort and then given up because it is, by almost all accounts, the world's hardest language to learn as an outsider. And we can get into why. I mean, I have the leg up that, like, the sounds make sense to me, words, that ring a bell. But I would like start with a book and give up and start and give up. And I finally just got over this hump, this hurdle sort of in the past year or so where it's starting to click. And like, I'm starting to like make connections between words and be like, oh, I get it. I get it. It's a very logical language, even though it is incredibly arcane. So I'm at this point now where I'm like, I'm really kind of obsessed with it and with like, filling spare time with doing any number of, language apps to practice and just memorize vocabulary and really like kind of changed from something I always wanted to do and thought I ought to do this to something that's like actively exciting and like fascinating and really, like really into it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I know... to a very small extent, what you're talking about. I'm learning French, and I've been doing it for less time, about half a year now. And I'm same thing. I'm using a language learning app, and I will say those apps very much gamify the process. Like, it makes you want to keep going. And I'm enjoying the process so far. But you mentioned how it is a very challenging language to learn. What is it about the language itself that makes it so difficult?
Okay. I'm going to start off with telling you the easy things because these are like the only things that are easy. So we should appreciate those. One is it's very phonetic with its alphabet. It used to be written in runes, but like that was ages ago. So it's just like very phonetic alphabet. And the one other really easy thing is that there's no grammatical gender. So you don't need to worry about that. Thank God. That said, God, it's everything else. It's not just different rules, it's different kinds of rules where, like, for instance, you use the verb changes not based on whether it's a transitive or intransitive verb, but whether with a transitive verb, the object is definite or indefinite, meaning I use a different verb to say I want a water than to say I want the water. The verb want would change.
Oof.
Right? Yeah. So, to a different, ending. And they're already infinite ending, right? So it's like on top of the like first, second, third, all, singular, plural, and then all the tenses, then for every one of them, you have a definite verb ending and an indefinite verb ending. And then there are these rules of vowel harmony where like, because it's a very agglomerative language. Like I put, there's a lot of suffixes and stuff that you stick on words. Mm-hmm. But depending what suffix you put on, you have to add a certain, like, okay, so like whether I'm adding an EM or an OM to put on a certain suffix depends on the previous vowels in the word you're attaching it to. But then when you add a suffix, all the vowels in the original word sometimes flip like little dominoes into other vowels. Is that like,
You know, you're describing it very well. I'm sorry, no one's going to be able to see this because obviously we're doing a podcast, but like I have had this like gobsmacked look as you've been describing this, just like, jaw agape, like, oh my God, like, that sounds like, this sounds so complex. And like, is Hungarian, forgive me for not knowing this, like there's a lot of languages that like polyglots, people who know a lot of languages, talk about being able, like if you can pick up one, it's easier to learn.
No. Okay. I mean, so here's the thing. It's not even Indo-European. Mm-hmm. Like English has more in common with like Hindi and Norwegian and like everything else than it does with Hungarian, which has basically no relatives, mm-hmm. except kind of sort of Finnish, but not really. So it's definitely not that like I studied French in high school and college, started learning Spanish with my kids. And I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, got it, right? Puerta y puerta, you know, like, I got it, right?
Yeah.
This is like nothing like that. So it would be, you know, if you know, so both of my parents were linguistics professors. This might've been relevant info for this conversation, actually. Okay. And they both spoke many, many languages. My father's passed away, my mother's alive. Yeah, like for my mother, who learned Hungarian as an outsider, I think it was definitely easier because, for instance, like she had studied Latin, which has cases, mm-hmm. and that you do need, like, you know, you need to have that information, like just to know what those things are. So you have these like file folders for certain things and you go, oh, it's agglomerative like German and it has the vowel sound, like its vowel sounds are kind of like Spanish. And like, so you could do that. But there are really no cognates, meaning there's like, you know, so like the word table, like is, you know, in most languages, it's either like, you know, tabula or table or mesa and things related to that, right? Spanish is, I mean, Hungarian, it's ostal. It has nothing to do with any other. So this is where that's easier for me because I've heard a lot of those words, not all of them, but it's like, okay, like that sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I didn't have that going, it would be a mess. And then the vowel harmony thing, because it's all sound-based, that's a little easier for me too. So I know what sounds right.
Yeah.
It's just Hungarian people do it, right? It just sounds right. So that's a little easier. But yeah, no, it's, God, it's super idiomatic where like, you know, you're like, I'll be typing one thing into Google Translate, and it'll be, and I'm making this up, I'm kidding, but it'll be like, you'll type in the word and it's like horse, but then you add, you know, suffix and it's like, you know, horsey, and then you add a different suffix and it's like, your mother is Spanish or something. It's like, how does that come from, what? And I'm kidding. But like, you just suddenly are in this other thing. I don't know. It's wild.
So what has kept you... Okay, this is going to look like a bad question, but like, so you said you've tried before and abandoned it. What has sort of kept you going this time?
I mean, partly it's that it's like, okay, I'm 45. Like, if I'm going to learn this, I need to do it now. My grandmother, my father's mother, was a novelist in Hungarian. She wrote 40 books and I've never been able to read them. So I would really like to be able to do that within my lifetime. Like, that seems important to me. And they're not translated into English and I could like pay someone, but it's not the same, right?
Yeah.
My father did move back to Hungary and then he passed away, but he, you know, that was sort of it. You know, I started to travel there a lot more often and I still go over there a lot more often now because my stepmother is there. And so that's just kind of increased exposure. And then, yeah, having the apps, having that, like, I will say with love, Duolingo Hungarian is terrible. I like Duolingo a lot. Someone like, you know, like other languages on Duolingo, they have like little lessons and they explain mm-hmm. stuff. Yep. Someone slapped up a Hungarian course and they have exercises, but zero explanations for anything.
Oh God.
So you're kind of in the chat with other people being like, wait, why? And they're like, I think it's because.
Oh my gosh.
But it's not good for learning. And I love Duolingo. They need to get their act together on the Hungarian, please.
I am super fascinated. I always tell people that I have a love of reading because I had a mother who taught for 40 years, and she gave me my love of reading. You have just told me in the last like 10 minutes that both of your parents were linguistics professors, and you had a grandparent who was a novelist. So, you know, I guess my simple question first is, like, what was it like growing up with two parents who were so fascinated, interested, studied, like, the concept of languages and words? Like, was that something that they brought home to your conversations?
Yeah. And I should say they divorced when I was 10. So, and before that they were living separately. So it's not necessarily this was happening at this time, but with my mom, she was really interested in child language development. That was one of her areas. She like did an inordinate amount of like nursery rhymes with me, like saying the first, you know, like letting me fill in the last word of the line of the nursery rhyme was like when I'm like, you know, one, two, like, cause I've heard it before. So she's like, Humpty Dumpty sat on and having me say it. Mm-hmm. And so just, you know, lots of books. So she was really great on that end of things. My father was the one who, like, you'd get him started and he'd be like, he'd start reciting poetry in Russian or something or laugh. Or he'd go off on the etymology of one word for like 45 minutes. So the first time that my husband had dinner with my father, met him, I think it was about 45 minutes on the word apricot. Yeah. Alone, like, okay, nobody asked, but thank you. It was fascinating. I don't particularly think that any of that made me a writer because I'm not into writing because I, quote unquote, love words. I think people who are, like, then poetry is great for them. I'm more allergic to bad sentences, if that makes sense. I'm never like, wow, you know, a word I love is cellar. Like, I'm just not one of those people. Mm. I take it for granted, I think. And it's just that more that, like, I'm really unhappy with a sentence that I don't love the sound of, but I'm in it for the storytelling, mm-hmm. not for the language.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I know what you mean about, like, thinking about your books, like, I definitely, like, if someone were to ask me, like, how would you describe, you know, like, Rebecca McKay's, like, writing, I would say, like, I can tell you care about, like you said, like, the sentence structure and, like, how something sounds, but more specifically, obviously, like, the story itself, I'm laughing. I'm allergic to bad sentences. I feel like that should be a t-shirt. I love that a lot. But, like, would you say that this, like, even if it isn't, like, your lifelong passion, like you said, it's something that your parents both did, but, like, having been surrounded by, like, this concept of other languages, and if nothing else, like, having a kind of tangential understanding of structure of languages and things, like, do you think that does affect your writing or how you try to structure your stories at all?
No, I don't.
No.
I like the question, but no, I think I've certainly, you know, there's been influence just in, like, my father was a really fascinating storyteller, just socially, more just like, but more about charm and, like, fabricated, like, exaggerating and fabrication. There's that, but I'm interested in, you know, I think, you know, you learn storytelling from what you read, and neither of my parents, like, we weren't like a big, like, I say that about my father, but it was much more like, you know, at dinner parties with other adults, like, you just hear him go off. We weren't like a storytelling family. We didn't, like, make up stories together or anything. It wasn't like that. But I, from a very, very young age, would just do that. Like, I'd be alone in the room with my little dolls and just making up stories. And having that instinct, you still have a ton to learn. But yeah, I don't think it has much to do with how I grew, particularly.
Yeah. Okay. So twisting the question a little bit then, like, for me, when I'm writing something, or like, I'm currently querying a manuscript, and the story that I wrote, despite, like, regardless of what the plot is, for me, what fascinates me is human interactions, human connections, kind of the relationships between two people. That's why, like, honestly, that's why I've been interviewing authors for 10 years, because, like, I love the fact that you and I are having, like, a half hour, 45 minute, like, human interaction right now that will never be repeated. I love those types of things. And so that's what I seek out in stories, either the ones that I'm writing or the ones that I'm reading. So for you, what is kind of your impetus for writing a story? Like, is there a an action that comes first? Is there a character that you think of? Like, what kind of is your wanting to write?
Now we're getting into like the, you know, this the question I'm asked all the time, which is fine. But I usually start with plot. I start with scenario. That's the stuff I write down in my notebook, is like a scenario, and I have no idea who these people are. And then I kind of reverse engineer that from there back into character. Like, okay, who get themselves in this mess, or what character would be the most susceptible to these circumstances, the most changed by these circumstances, the most vulnerable to these circumstances. Figure out who that is, and that's usually where I go.
Mm-hmm. So when you're seeking out books to read, like, what are the types of stories you are drawn to as a reader?
Honestly, type does not matter much to me. I tend to go on, honestly, it's a couple of things. I recommendations from very, very smart people. Like, I need to know, like, I have a very low tolerance for writing that I don't like, or that, you know, I'd say bad writing and or writing that I don't like. I just have, like, I'm not going to sit there and read something that I don't think it's well written. And there, because there's so much stuff that is well written, right? It's like, why would you waste your time on something that's not great? And then I, very often, it's also just like, I need something that's not going to bore me. I do have ADHD. I'm not the person for a really quiet, meditative novel where not much happens. That's just not for me. And then I'm not a good reader for fantasy sci-fi stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't mean, I don't mean that something has to happen in the real world. I just mean, like, when we get into, like, other realms and portals and stuff, I'm just, I honestly, it bores me. I tune out, I zone out, I'm just not into it. So within, and then, like, before, you know, so like, so I don't get canceled by anyone who listens to this, of course there was good stuff, blah, 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 and it's brilliant, and I didn't mean it, and it's all great, and I'm probably just jealous or something. Anyway, within that, it's, you know, is like, is, does this look completely non-boring, and have I heard that it is amazing? Mm-hmm. Then I don't care what it is. Just, you know, a little bit of a veto in certain subjects, but I assume, you know, like, other people loved it, but that doesn't mean I will love it, because I tend not to get into this genre, right?
Yeah, no, you're in a safe space here. I know what you mean. Like, there are some sci-fi and fantasy I do like, but I found, like, as I get a little bit older, and the same thing, like, I think my brain works a certain way where I can't fully visualize the world that these authors have built, and, like, that's not on them, that's on me. So I'm like, kind of, I find myself, like, skimming through those passages about very important world building, and then when they talk about like a magic set or a version, like, something that happened, I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, and it's on me, it's not on them. So I know what you mean. I'm the same way.
No, that's it. It's not, you know, it's not that I don't think that those are great or have merit. It's like I don't like them. It's me, right? It's like, I also don't like beets. There's nothing wrong with beets. They're very healthy. I'm glad that people love them. I don't like beets.
Yeah, you can listen. You can DNF a book. You can DNF a beet. Yeah, it's totally fine. Don't worry about it. Right. Yeah. So I will say, like, one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to you is because you write books that I absolutely adore. And so, you know, with your new book out, by the time, you know, people hearing this are either have already gotten or will be able to go get, I have some questions for you. So for people who may not have had a chance to read it yet, can you kind of give them an introduction to the book?
Yeah, this is the 1 minute one. because I've got all lengths of description, believe me. We have a 40-year-old woman. Her name is Bodhi Kane. She is invited back just for 2 weeks in the dead of winter to teach at the boarding school that she attended as a pretty adrift scholarship kid in the 90s. And while she's back there, her mind is, of course, back on the 90s, very specifically on the death in their senior year of a young woman named Thalia Keith, who had been her roommate briefly. Thalia was found dead in the campus swimming pool, but with significant injuries to her body. And very quickly, a young Black man who worked at the school as an athletic trainer was arrested and imprisoned with what seemed like a lot of evidence against him. There are a whole lot of people online who believe that he's innocent. one of Bodhi's students in those 2 weeks is among them, believes the wrong person is in prison and wants to do her class project on this. Bodhi is both really terrified of that concept of poking her nose in and also very eager to learn things she doesn't know. And we go from there.
Yeah. First off, I love the structure of the story. And I want to ask, like, and I'm going to be like kind of vague with the question because I don't want to give much away of the plot. But, like, are there aspects of, like, not so much modern society, but like modern content and the ways that people are learning about stories, and you know, everyone in 2023 is a murder mystery expert now. Like, are there, how much research did you want to do into the ways that people take in stories like the Serial podcast and things like that to write a story where there is some of that aspect in there? Like, how much are you looking at the way that we as a society like connect with stories like this now in real life, or is it something you kind of keep separate?
Right. No, I was interested in taking sort of the true crime industrial complex as a subject of the book.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm fundamentally writing fictional crime, of course, not true crime. But basically, the idea here, in some ways, being okay, let's take the kind of crime that seems custom tailored to become clickbait. Like, you know, beautiful, young, dead girl, wealthy, at a boarding school, blah, blah, blah. And let's de-genrefy that, right? There's this sort of genre of like, it's perfect for true crime. Let's actually look at that realistically. Like, let's not look at it. Like, this book, you know, kind of has it both ways in that it is a murder mystery in that by the end of the book, we basically know who did it. But other than that, like, you know, I'm not very interested in participating in the conventions of the mystery genre. I'm not against them, right? It's just not what the book is. Rather, like, okay, like, what does an actual criminal investigation look like under these circumstances? What happens within the carceral system in these circumstances? What happens when, you know, what happens to a case when there is significant public attention on it at the time, over the years? So what does that do to the family? What does that do to the police? What does that do to the family, you know, the suspects? So, you know, I'm already someone who is both drawn to consuming true crime media and alarmed at that and questioning it. Like, there's good that's come out of that, bad that comes out of that. And so I wanted to write about that. I don't have a thesis statement on it. I just wanted that to be kind of what we're mucking around in this novel.
Do you feel differently from when you started writing the novel to now about kind of just those aspects of society in general?
No, not really. I think I knew going in, you know, that it's human instinct to be interested in that. Then we overindulge in it. And I also think that I knew going in that there's a lot of damage that attention can do. There's also a lot of good that attention can do. Mm. And, you know, like, for instance, the murder stuff in South Carolina recently, that was a set of circumstances in which without the broader national interest, I don't think that guy would have been brought to justice at all because of who his family was within that tiny community. But when you have everybody looking at it, it looks really different. And then you get these other murders starting to get reinvestigated of, you know, this young queer kid who, like, was really swept under the rug. That wouldn't have happened if it weren't for these podcasts and things really shining a spotlight on it. So there's that. There is, you know, Adnan Syed, you know, was released from prison, and now there's a whole other thing going on with that. But that public attention, you know, has done a lot there. A lot of other times when it's like, why do we need to keep talking about Jeffrey Dahmer, though? Like, what is that going to do? It is over. It's done. It's solved. These poor families, like, what are we doing? And it's hard to know, of course, going in, like, which one it is necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, is it done? I don't know. So anyway, that's stuff that I've always, I think that the novel ends up saying things that I maybe hadn't articulated to myself before, but it's not like I had some big revelation or reversal of the way I think about it.
I was mainly just curious because I know how much time you as an author have spent with this story. And like, It wouldn't have shocked me if you were like, yeah, I needed a break from all that at this point. But I'm always curious, you know, if having dug so deeply into the content of your story, like what it would lead to. So I want to be respectful of time. I always end my podcast by having the author who's come on give a recommendation of any kind. It can be a book. It could be a TV show. It could be a recipe. I've had people recommend going for a walk. I had someone recommend a protein powder. Any recommendation you would like more people to know about?
Yeah, no, I think I'll say since we were talking about Hungarian, I'll tell you this Hungarian novel that I read in English because I'm not that far yet. Recently, it's a well-known one. It's The Door by Magda Szabo. I had not read it until this fall, and people had asked me often if I'd read it, just knowing that I'm Hungarian, and I hadn't. And it's good. It's real. Have you read it?
I have not, but I am absolutely going to. This sounds, I'm very interested.
It is about a woman's relationship with her very, very strange house cleaner. Mm. And the first like three quarters really of the book are kind of all character study, and it's fascinating, but nothing's really happening. And but in a way that I couldn't put down. And then the last quarter, like, all this stuff happens. You know all the way through that something ended in disaster, which I think is the reason it's so compelling. You're like waiting for this disaster to strike. Mm-hmm. And then it does. And it is so good.
Yeah. I have one more quick question for you. I grew up in a town called Lorain, Ohio. It's actually where Toni Morrison was born. It's like our claim to fame. It is very much a melting pot of Eastern European everythingness. And so I grew up with many friends who are Hungarian. So this is a very important last question. What is your favorite Hungarian dish? Like, what is your favorite Hungarian food?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I make would be paprikash, specifically paprikash csirke, so like chicken paprikash. And I love that. It's great comfort food. I make my own noodles for it and everything. That's love making that. The one that I haven't even really tried making because I think I don't have, I will try it, but that I'd rather just get there would be halaszle, which is this very, can be very, very spicy fisherman's soup. It's like a red fish soup that is, in its spiciest iterations, has literally been a challenge on The Amazing Race.
Oh my God.
And they were like passing out. It's not usually served that ridiculous. Mm. Whatever, and they're, you know, every family has its own recipe. You get me started, I'm gonna go on. But dessert, there's this pastry called kremesh that's like I have no idea how to describe it. It's like a very like custardy, mm-hmm. with a crust under it. That is really, really, really good, and I've never managed to make that either.
That is, if I hadn't asked you that question, I know after like when this episode went out, I would get texts from old friends like, really? You didn't ask about food? So I had to do that. Rebecca, this was so delightful and informative and fun. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Passions and Prologues is proud to be an Evergreen podcast and was created by Adam Sokol. It was produced by Adam Sokol and Sean Rule Hoffman. And if you are interested in this podcast and any other Evergreen podcast, you can go to evergreenpodcast.com to discover all the different stories we have to tell.
Welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our 9th season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.